The Orthodox Christian Network is honored to present the following recording from the Orthodox Christian Association of Medicine, Psychology, and Religion's 2013 annual conference, Care of the Aging Patient, A Medical Perspective, delivered by Helen C. Kales, M.D.
It's my great honor to introduce the first speaker. Her CV is in your packet. It is a very impressive CV. It would take me an awful long time to go through it all. But nevertheless, Dr. Helen Kales, an associate professor of psychiatry and director of the Section of Geriatric Psychiatry, University of Michigan. She's a board certified geriatric psychiatrist. She is a founding director of the Program for Positive Aging. Don't you love that term, positive aging? And the Associate Director of Mental Health and Aging Research at the University of Michigan Geriatric Center. Dr. Kales is a core investigator of the VA in our, what is this, HSR&D Center for Clinical Management and Research, as she is recognized as an international expert in outcomes related to depression in later life, as well as those associated with neuropsychiatric symptoms of dementia and environmental epidemiology research related to the use of antipsychotics in the elderly. If you would like to read the rest of it, it is extraordinarily impressive. I have to tell you a story, though. As I was trying to put together the speakers, trying to figure out which medicine person can we get who can speak on this topic authoritatively. I called Dan Inshaw in Virginia, in Michigan, an old friend of mine, and I said, Dan, do you have any thoughts so we can get it? Because I just got the perfect woman for you, perfect psychiatrist, and gave me Dr. Kales' name. So I called Dr. Kales. I said, Dr. Kales, I'm Dan DeMacus. He says, Dr. DeMantis, you don't remember me, do you? Now, when someone tells you that, you really don't see. Well, how should I know this lady? Something bad, something good? What happens, I was the director of the VA's Health Services Research that gave her career development and then her advanced career development. She's one of our stars at the VA, and she moved on. I'm really an exemplary career. It gives me great pleasure to introduce our first speaker, Dr. Helen Kales.
Wonderful to be here, and I just want to thank Dr. DeMacus for inviting me and Opamper as well. And I'll tell a little story about Dr. DeMacus, which was when I went to my first career development day that they had every year. Once you got your career development award, you stood in front of us, and I can't remember the Greek, so forgive me, but you said a Greek saying, which was, if you're going to come to the dance, dance. And what you were saying to us was, stop figuring out all these like little bitsy facts about things and actually implement some things. And I've done that. So I did listen to you. So if we could go to the next slide. So no disclosures, I have to say that. And what I'm going to talk about next slide is three main topics today. So we're going to talk about later life depression, and how it might differ from depression we might be familiar with from earlier adulthood. I'm going to talk a bit about dementia and mainly focus on the behavioral symptoms of dementia, which are very stressful to caregivers. And lastly, I'm going to talk about positive aging, which you might say to yourself, is this for real or am I sort of an optimistic Pollyanna? And the answer to that is yes and yes. So, so I'll go to the next one. So I'm going to ask you guys a few questions. It's the morning, but let's get going. And by show of hands, I'd like you to give me your best guess as to the answers to these questions. And we'll hopefully answer them later today. But which do you think is the biggest contributor to the development of later life depression? Is it A, genes, it's all your parents' fault? B, getting old, it's a bummer? C, medical illness, depression and illness go hand in hand? Or D, losses, which is that depression is inevitable after sad events. So give me a show of hands for A, genes, okay. We have some geneticists in the audience. Getting old, it's a bummer, anybody? How about medical illness? Okay, so a few more. And lastly, losses. Okay. So actually, losses is a big one, but we'll talk about why that's not the complete answer. Medical illness is the answer, and medical illness is really the hallmark of later life depression. So let's go to the next one. True or false, sad mood is a requirement for the diagnosis of late life depression. How many people think that's true? Okay, false. Good. So we'll talk about that as well. Next, true or false, when you're interviewing an older patient, we should assume his or her memory is intact unless he or she expresses concerns. True or false? True? False. Good. I might need to go home. All right, next one. Behavioral symptoms like wandering, repetitive questioning, anxiety, depression, psychosis are found in what percentage of patients? A, 5%, B, 20%, C, 50%, or D, more than 90%. So show of hands for A, okay, B, okay, C, and D. The answer is D. Very, very, very common. Last question, or actually second to last question. Which of the following may be the most important determinant of aging well? So again, is it your genes? Again, it's your parents' fault. B, a resilient coping style. C, having few or no medical illnesses. Or D, healthy diet and exercise. You are what you eat. So is it A, who says? B, C, or D? So this is a bit of a trick question because a bit of all of them are true, but the best answer is actually B, so resilient coping style. All right, last question, and I'll stop torturing you. What are geriatric psychiatrists and what do they do? People often have no idea what I do. So A, no idea, enough questions. B, psychiatrists that have extra comfy couches for their older patients' comfort. C, psychiatrists that have gotten old and should be put out to pasture. Or D, psychiatrists that specialize in the mental health issues of later life, like depression and dementia. And I think the answer is D. All right, so we'll go on to the next slide. So this is actually a friend of mine's slide, but she told me I had to put it in today. She said, you have to proselytize for geriatric psychiatry. So here it is. We are people that have trained in psychiatry, and then we get extra training in geriatrics for one or more years. So I did a two-year fellowship. So there's all that schooling, and then we get certified by a separate board for our subspecialty. So next slide. So what do? We generally evaluate, a lot of people think that psychiatrists, again, kind of put people on the couch, and we talk about childhoods and such, but it's really different than that. So in later life, what we're focusing on is diagnosing, evaluating, and treating disorders like later life depression, dementia, and other mental health issues. We really practice, it's very popular now to say patient and family-centered care, but this is what we do by the nature of our work. My favorite thing is when I go out into the waiting room and I see a group of people standing up with the patient, that means we've got a team going. So this is what we do. We integrate with medicine and neurology, and we integrate also community resources and support. And our goal is really to maximize functionality of the patient and quality of life. And then lastly, we train other providers. So when we assess people, what we do is we take a history from multiple sources, and again, usually it's the patient, but it's also the family members and others who may be involved. We do a medical evaluation and laboratory testing because there's some medical issues that may masquerade as what looks like psychiatric. We review medications. I put a picture of a brown bag because we actually ask our elders to bring in that bag when they come in for the evaluation, because you would be surprised at what people are taking. Their wife's Xanax, some Benadryl, some Tylenol PM. All these things can have effects on cognition and mood, so we need to know about them. And lastly, we do a cognitive screening. Next slide. And the next slide. So later life depression. I wanted to start out with a case that's a very typical case that we would see in clinic. And so this is Mrs. L. She's 75. And she comes in and she says she's feeling fidgety and itchy. She's withdrawing from activities. We get that from the family. Her appetite is low. She's lost 15 pounds, probably over a two-month time frame. She's having trouble concentrating, and she expresses a very common complaint. She's forgetting where things are. She puts her keys down, and then she doesn't remember where she left them. She actually has some passive suicidality, which is she wishes she wouldn't wake up in the morning sometimes. She has no formal psych history. Like many of our patients, these are people who are seeing a psychiatrist for the very first time. They have a lot of strengths and have never had such a trouble in their life. She had a possible postpartum depression, but never sought treatment. And importantly, she's a caregiver for her husband, Mr. L, and she says it's very, very stressful. Go on. So later life depression, if you look at the big studies, like the epidemiologic catchment area study, they show that rates of depression among our elders are actually low, but we think that's only part of the story. And part of it is that elders may not express the full major depressive episode that younger people do. If you look at symptoms, the symptoms may be present in 1 in 5 older adults. And importantly, these symptoms and the syndromes increase, as I said before, with medical illness. So while rates may be only 5% if you look at community elders, if you go into medical settings, like people that are in the hospital or people that are in an outpatient clinic, the rates really climb. And if you go into a nursing home, they climb even further. So again, it tracks with this medical illness. And as you see from the chart, it also tracks with certain diseases. So after a stroke, gave me a pointer. Let's see. After a stroke, whoop, can you go back? Did I do that? Oh, okay. this is stroke. 47% of people after a stroke may have a depression, and that's because of some of the brain circuits that get affected. Parkinson's disease is another one. Very high presence of depression, again, because of the brain circuitry involved. So again, this tracking with medical illness, and what depression does is it adds on disability. So if you have a medical illness, it makes you even more disabled. It worsens outcome, and of course, it causes a lot of suffering. So we'll go into the next one. So you probably can't see this completely, but what I want to highlight here is that there is no one depression of later life. I would say there are depressions. So remember earlier I asked about losses and we talked about genetics. It's probably a complex interplay where people may have genetic tendencies toward depression. As we know, it runs in families. Then they may hit a psychosocial loss, like the loss of a spouse. They may also have some brain changes due to vascular disease. And what these may do is interact together to kick off the depression. So it's sort of an interacting picture. The next one. So importantly, this heterogeneity that I mentioned affects the presentation. So you guys answered the question right earlier about sadness. One of the very important things about older adults is they may not show sadness when they're depressed. And we think that may be for a couple of reasons, one of which is the current cohort of our elders were raised during the Depression. And I always think of my yaya when I think of this, because as my mom knows, she became depressed later in life, but we didn't spot it initially, because my yaya was a person who didn't talk about being sad. She had had to take over the running of a business when my grandfather got sick, and so she would have looked at it as a stigma or a shame to talk about depression, but what yaya talked about was her stomach. And my mom ended up taking her to many specialists, as I recall. And then finally, we started to think, wait a minute, she's not responding to these treatments, she's losing weight, she's even expressing some passive suicidality. Yaya's depressed. And yet, she never said she was sad. So that's a very important thing. And we call that mask depression in the elderly, a sort of denial of sadness. They may endorse other symptoms, like somatic symptoms, so bodily sensations, pain. And that's not to say that those illnesses aren't existing or they're in the person's head. But with Yaya, she had the illness, but it was amplified by the depression. So it's very important to think. And if you remember one thing that I talk about today, it's that depression is not a normal outgrowth of aging. So that's the other thing about our current cohort of elders. Many of them think, well, I'm old, so isn't it natural to become depressed? And actually, it's not. We see many people, and I'll present some research later, that older people actually tend to be more resilient than younger people. So this is an important point. We go on the next one. So what does depression look like? These are the Bible of psychiatry, if you will, is the DSM, and we could debate whether that should actually be the Bible. It's sort of controversial sometimes. But the criteria are depressed mood, and that could be in an older person, anxiety or irritability, importantly, or anhedonia, which is the lack of enjoyment. So in an older person, if they don't show sad mood, what you may want to look for is this lack of enjoyment. Withdrawing from social activities. Does Yaya want the grandchildren to leave the house earlier because they're getting on her nerves, where she used to really look forward to those visits? Or Papu, does he like fishing, but he really just doesn't feel like doing it anymore? So that withdrawal from activities. I don't feel well enough, I don't have the energy. Families may also see that the person starts to neglect their appearance or their home where they get used to. So this is a very important cardinal symptom. Now, in addition to the cardinal symptoms, which are here and here, they may also have a sleep disturbance, an appetite or weight change, go on to the next slide, decreased energy, and that one can be tough in older people because they may have decreased energy for other reasons, like physical issues, so that's a tough one. Agitation or slowing down, decreased concentration, which again is tough because that forgetfulness, like Mrs. L was talking about, can be difficult to distinguish from dementia. They may feel guilty, worthless, or like a burden. Importantly, suicidal ideation and worsened physical or pain symptoms. So next one. So a word about depression and cognition. This is probably the number one consult we get in clinic of an older person coming in with both mood symptoms and memory symptoms. They seem to travel together in many older people. And even people who are not demented, as we would say, have trouble with concentration, speed of processing, and executive function, which is that sort of organizing, sequencing, and planning that we all need to do things like balance checkbooks, drive cars, and so on. Many of these symptoms get better with treatment, but can be an early manifestation of something more permanent. So we want to keep an eye on this. And importantly, depression can either be a first symptom of dementia, or it could be a risk factor. So those people who have lifelong depressions and they never get treated, that may be a risk factor for dementia in later life. So next slide. A word about caregiving. This is sort of the unknown burden in our society that we're becoming more aware of. With the rise in the elderly, many, many people are informal caregivers, and this is a tough job. There's no school for it. People become caregivers, they're drafted into it, and there's no training. So they are 2 times as likely as non-caregivers to develop depression. It's very stressful. Those who experience emotional strain are also more likely to die than non-caregivers. And what makes it worse is if they are caring, like Mrs. L, for a person with behavioral symptoms of dementia. Those are very stressful. And importantly, those people who receive limited help from others. So they kind of don't ask for help, they go down with the ship. Those are the people I worry about. A word about bereavement. I think many of us, and especially those in the clergy, will see people who are grieving. And so we often get asked, well, do you treat that? And this is actually made more confusing by DSM because they recently removed what was called the bereavement exclusion from the diagnosis of depression. And I'd be interested in Brenda's opinion on this as well, but I actually think people people need to go through a period of grief. I think it's important for them to acknowledge the loss that they've had. But what I would say is we watch people carefully, and if the grief becomes what I would call complicated, where they start becoming suicidal, or they literally can't function after a few months, then we might intervene. But I'm not in favor of medicating, you know, somebody early on after a loss. Go on to the next one. So back to Mrs. L. What would we do with her? We would get more history. It would be important to talk to people that know her well. She might minimize symptoms, so we want to find out from other people what they're seeing. We want to do a mood and cognitive screening, review her medical issues and medications. Substance abuse history is important. Often in our elders, people say, oh, well, let them do that, you know. And I'll talk to you in a minute about why it's important not to let it go. We'll assess her level of burden and then look at suicidality. So this is called the Geriatric Depression Scale, and I just wanted to put it up because it's a validated instrument in the elderly that we use in clinic. And so basically it asks questions like, are you satisfied with life? Have you dropped many of your activities and interests? And a score of 5 or more on this suggests depression. And Mrs. L gets a score of 8. Now, I will say that there are some people, and I'm trying not to be genderist, but often older men will minimize symptoms on this. So I'll be giving them this thing, and they'll be shaking their head, and I'll look at their wife, and she'll be going like this. And that's where the collateral information is very important, because, again, people may tend to minimize some of their symptoms. Go to the next one. This is called the MoCA. Has anybody ever seen this? Okay, so one person. How many here have ever heard of the mini mental status exam? Okay, so more. So this is something we use with people like Mrs. L. It's kind of an updated version of the mini mental status exam. And why we use it is it has some different features. People who are highly educated or early on in cognitive impairment tend to breeze through the MMSE. It's easy for them. This gives them a little harder task. They have to complete a sort of trail test where they have to see what the pattern is and then complete it. They have to do a cube. They have to construct a clock, putting in the hands. So it's a little more complicated, and it gives us that view onto what I call executive function, so sequencing, organizing, and planning. And in somebody like Mrs. L, who's pretty functional, this is where I want to look with her to see if we're worried. And actually, I wouldn't be worried about her at this point because she's scoring a 27 out of 30. And I would really be looking at more of a score of below 25 to start to be concerned. Somebody with depression also may have trouble with attention. So if she gets some of the attentional items wrong, I'm not going to be as worried. Okay, we'll go to the next one. We look at her medical history, hypertension, hypothyroidism, and sleep apnea. So important here, we want to make sure that her hypertension is adequately treated. Somebody who's hypertensive as it was for stroke, and obviously that would be a bad thing to happen to Mrs. L. Hypothyroidism causes symptoms that look like depression, so we want to make sure that's adequately treated. We probably check a TSH level, which would tell us if she's in the ballpark of normal there. If she wasn't, we need to talk to her PCP about supplementing her. And sleep apnea, how many people here are familiar with this? So what's very important with this disorder is it causes a myriad of symptoms in older people. Mood problems like dysphoria causes excessive daytime sleepiness, so they may be falling asleep during the day, and it can cause confusion. And unfortunately, with the current treatments, which are positive airway pressure, how many people have seen the contraptions that people wear? Okay. My mother-in-law wears one, and she's actually very compliant, but many people aren't because they're very uncomfortable. They tell me, Dr. Kales, I wake up in the middle of the night, I take it off. So what's ending up happening with them is they may be having 300 or so micro-awakenings in the night because their oxygen levels are plummeting. So not only are they tired the next day, they're putting themselves at risk of stroke and other very bad illnesses. So we want to make sure that she is using her apparatus. Her medications, we want to look at to make sure that there's nothing there that could be contributing. And looking at this list, does anybody see anything they'd be concerned about? Yes, what do you see?
The cooler as.
Right. So this is very common for an older person who's fidgety or anxious to get put on. And the problem with medications like the benzodiazepines, this is actually Ativan, for those of you that might know that name better, they cause confusion and they cause falls. So I don't like to see this on the medication list. And what we may need to do with her is get her on an antidepressant first, and then hopefully once that works, take her off of that, because I wouldn't want to change things in the midst of treatment. But I have my eye on this to say, boy, we really need to get rid of this ultimately. So we'll go to the next one. So her substance use. 2 glasses of Chardonnay a day. You might say, let Mrs. L drink. She's, you know, having a hard time. The issue with this is, if somebody's depressed, it's a depressant, right? So if I give them something like Celexa, it's kind of counteracting that, and we don't want that. The other thing is, it messes up sleep architecture. So if Mrs. L is having trouble sleeping, it may help her get to sleep, but then she may have middle-of-the-night awakenings. So what I talk to people about is, let's try to lower that. And again, you also need to ask, what size are those glasses? Because if it's like this, you know, that's more concerning than if it's like that. The other thing is, I'm a coffee drinker, you know, I have my cup of coffee back there, but if somebody's anxious, they may need to cut back on the caffeine, because that's going to make them more nervous. So again, you know, we're not saying, you know, you can't do any of these things, but limit it. Next slide. We check her labs, as I mentioned, get the full extent of her use of these substances, and then, as I said, adherence to the CPAP treatment for sleep apnea. Next. So I kind of listed these and I've gone over them with you. This, I just want to highlight, suicidality and safety. A number of years ago, there was an important study that came out where a person at Rochester, University of Rochester, Gates Conwell, actually did what he called a psychological autopsy. So he got all the records of people that had committed suicide in that county, older people. And then he linked it with medical records, and he found that 40% of the people that committed suicide had seen their primary care doctor in the month before their suicide. And that sort of shook the field a bit, because we realized that there was an opportunity there, perhaps, to intervene. And at the time, many primary care physicians said, but if I ask about it, I may cause them to do it. And that's actually not the case. What we find is that asking a person about suicide or suicidal thoughts can really unburden them, because they may feel really terrible about having these thoughts, and talking about them can kind of get it out in the open. So it's very important to ask about. And importantly, does anybody here know who has the highest suicide rates in the population? Yes?
I'd say elderly men.
Elderly men, 6 times that of anybody else. And it's elderly white men in specific. And the unfortunate thing is that when these folks, what happens is their completion rates are so high. So a younger person that we might see in our psych emergency room takes a, you know, a couple Benadryl. Well, that's actually, I mean, fortunately not going to do any long-standing harm. Older white men have high rates of firearm use. And so when they do something, it really is final. And so we want to try to catch that before it happens. And lastly, with her treatment, we need to look at her relationship with her husband. I mentioned earlier that she's a caregiver, so this is an important piece. Let's go on to the next one. A word about therapies. I think that Brenda will be talking about this more, but I just want to say, in the elderly, the evidence-based is best for really 3 types of therapy. So I said before, we don't put people on couches anymore. Cognitive behavioral therapy, which many older people have many negative thoughts when they're depressed, which is bad things always happen to me, they're always going to happen to me, I'm not a good person. And what we try to do with these folks with CBT is to have them identify when they're doing these negative thoughts and change them so that they think a bit differently, because thoughts are linked to emotions. So I'm vastly oversimplifying it, but I just want to mention that that's a major type of therapy. Problem-solving therapy is another, where we identify what the active day-to-day problems are for the person, and we brainstorm with them some solutions and then work with them on implementing those solutions. So that's a second type. And that one is particularly helpful if there's some cognitive impairment. Intrapersonal therapy is the last one, which is focusing on relationship issues. And in practice, we may do a mix of these things. So we'll go to the next one. A brief word about medications. I don't want to bore you too much, but the mainstays are the antidepressants, which are the newer antidepressants that I've listed here. Citalopram and sertraline are probably our first choices. Citalopram is Celexa. Sertraline is Zoloft, so you may have heard of those. Fluoxetine is Prozac. That was sort of the first of the newer antidepressants. We don't use that a lot in the elderly because it often causes anxiety early on. And you may have one shot with an older person before they say, I don't want to have anything to do with you or your medication. So I wouldn't choose that one first. Conversely, paroxetine or Paxil can make people feel somewhat sedated and also cause weight gain. So I may not use that one. The interesting thing is we tend to use these medications for their side effect profiles. So, for example, if somebody was actually the opposite profile, where as opposed to being anxious, they were sort of sluggish, I actually might consider Prozac. And if they were sort of very anxious, paroxetine actually might be a choice. So again, we sort of use those side effect profiles. We go to the next one. These are second-line agents. Bupropion is Wellbutrin. And mirtazapine is Remeron. So those two are also used second line. Mirtazapine can make people quite sleepy, and where that is useful in a low dose is if somebody is having sleep problems, because as opposed to giving Mrs. L a benzodiazepine and an antidepressant, perhaps we could just give her the Remeron. Tricyclics are still occasionally used, but because of side effects and monitoring, we use them less often. So look at the next. If we do medications, we're going to start extremely low. So if, for example, was Celexa, if an earlier adult would get 20 milligrams, we might start with 5 or 10, very slow, and then increase it over a couple weeks. The ultimate dose might be that of a younger person, but again, we're just going to take our time to get there. We don't stop. That's what we often see in primary care is people say, well, they're old, so I don't want to give them too much medication, and then they're still depressed. So you just have to be very patient. It may take up to 12 weeks to titrate that medication. What about families? Father Chris on the OCN radio network asked me a great question about this, and as I said, I always love it when I go to the waiting room and, you know, 10 people stand up. Families are critical for depression. They are the first to notice that something is different often. They can help get the loved one to an assessment. Often the loved one won't want to go. They also can create the situations needed for social engagement. So many of our elders, as part of depression, may not want to go places, but I hear from the families. But once they get there, they're okay. So it's the getting them there that the families really take an active role in. And to help prevent future episodes, they can help them manage their stress and their medical conditions, and again, reemphasize that social engagement. So there's a church you'll recognize. And what role does religious participation play? The more we know about this research, which is an active area, is that it does decrease the chance of becoming depressed, and if you are depressed, it decreases the chance of recurrence. So there have been those naysayers who say, well, that's just because you're getting people together. It's just social engagement. But the research actually shows that the benefits are beyond that of social engagement. They're the social engagement plus the impact of religious participation and spirituality. The positives is it helps people to cope with life stressors, gives them hope and meaning, and then provides that supportive community. So then Father Chris asked me a good question. What about the negatives? And we do see those. And where I see that is when older people have that feeling that they are being punished because of a depression, they may view the depression as God's will. And I think that's where it's very important for clergy to come in and reinterpret those beliefs that this is not God's will, just as it's not God's will for you to, you know, die of a heart attack because we have doctors that can help you manage your cardiac stressors. It's also God's will to help get treatment, whether that's psychotherapy, medications, or some other type of counseling. So this is where I think the clergy can play a very important role. So any questions before I go on to dementia? Yes?
I have a question. You identified the different aspects that might be contributing to depression, including the medical or genetic. What I'm wondering is, in your treatment approach, you discuss cognitive behavioral strategies, and then all the way down to interpersonal. I'm struck that you don't specifically do loss and grief and then bereavement and just loss, you know, looking at just the issues of loss at this stage, number one, as a whole, as one of the arms right up there with, you know, medical issues. Number two, family.
Yes.
You mentioned family as kind of the periphery of treatment. And I'm curious about family being kind of in the center of assessing and in the center of treatment, meaning this, you know, just like the caregiver, you know, the relationship between Mrs. L and Mr. L has got to be critical to looking at her well-being.
Yeah.
What about her relationship with her kids and her grandkids and how much that contributes to you? It's a dominant factor. So those are the two things I'm just...
So those are great and very important points. And as I said, I was really glossing over psychotherapy, and because I know Brenda is going to be talking more about that. Addressing loss is critical. And so, you know, and really, I think of my job as tailoring the treatment to the individual. So I'm not going to give CBT to every person. You know, each person is different, and also their insight and ability to do various types of psychotherapy differs. There may be those with great insight who can really look, and there may be those who really don't want to look. So we have to tailor it to where that person is, but loss is huge, and I think that coping with loss is an important part of treatment. But that said, not everybody that becomes depressed is because of a loss. So again, it's that tailoring. The question about family, I was thinking as you talk, it's so central that I have a family in the visit. And that's different than most of psychiatry, where you would never have the daughter, the son. And, you know, of course, sometimes for autonomy's sake, we have to split that up and say, we'll give you 10 minutes, and then we need 10 minutes alone with Mrs. L. It's a balancing act, and it's very important. And figuring out where the family is, and also families disagree. So that's also a really fun part of my job, where there are factions of the family that want one thing, and factions that, and you try to work with the one that makes the most sense. So those are great points, and because it's, I'm trying to work in all these topics, forgive me for my brevity. So we'll go into dementia. And now we're going to hear about Mr. L. So he's also a complicated guy. He's a bit older than Mrs. L, 79, and a successful engineer. And I can make fun of engineers because my husband's one. And what I find with older engineers is that they, even after retirement, they still like things just so. So I had one engineer in my practice who took his blood pressure about 50 times a day and would bring me printouts of these blood pressures. He, like Mrs. L, knows psychiatric history. No medical problems, actually, except for nocturia. He has to go to the bathroom at night, and his physician gave him ditropan, or oxybutynin. Here's the problem. He's been getting lost while driving, but still thinks he should drive. He can no longer balance his checkbook without help. He was always the one that kept track of the finances. And Mrs. L, as she's going out the door, whispers to me, I'm walking on eggshells. And what she means there is he's increasingly angry and irritable with her specifically. So we'll go on to the next one. So we do an interview with him, and importantly, his memory is grossly intact, but as often what I see with couples, Mrs. L starts to fill in the gaps for him when he pauses. And he gets very irritable when she helps him, kind of snaps at her. As the interview concludes, she stays behind, and this happens to me all the time. They start Mr. L walking, and she's like, you know, talking to me to get it out before he notices. Mr. L's driving her crazy, or his driving is crazy, and he's driving her crazy. He's had several near accidents, and he's getting lost going to familiar places. So places he should know how to get, he's getting lost. He recently saw his PCP, and there were no new medical issues, and his lab panel that the PCP did was within normal limits. So the PCP checked all the things I'd like to have checked. We again repeat the MOCA with him, but he does not do as well as Mrs. L. He has trouble completing this, so he cannot see the pattern. He gets very confused. He has a lot of trouble with the clock. It's very messed up. He has trouble with his memory, so a portion of this is asking people to remember words after 5 minutes. He can't do that. And he cannot abstract. So abstraction is asking people to kind of go beyond the concrete, and he has trouble doing that. So we ask questions on here like, how are an apple and an orange similar? And the right answer to that is, well, they're both fruits. But somebody who's being very concrete may give us an answer to say something like, well, they both have peels. Do you see what I'm saying? So we're looking at him to kind of categorize, and he has trouble doing that. His score is 19 out of 30, which is in the trouble range. Is it gone? So with him, what we're going to do is talk to the PCP about an alternative to his ditropan. So ditropan is that agent, as I mentioned, that prevents bladder spasm, but it has what we call anticholinergic effects. And anticholinergic effects in the brain cause people to be confused. That could be making him worse. So we want to find an alternative to that, and there are medications that would be better. We'll reassess his cognition after we do that. We'll then refer him to a neuropsychologist who can give us a more pinpointed, what I just did and showed you was a screen, but we want to know what areas of the brain are working well that we can work with and what areas are having more problems. We're going to send him for a driving evaluation, which is going to make me very unpopular, but we'll say to him, you know what, you say you're really good at driving, show me. And often they'll say, well, that examiner was terrible, she wasn't good, but that information is very important. And this is really key. I hate to hear those stories. You hear them once a year where an older person plows into a crowd of people. That's kind of my nightmare, and that's what we want to prevent here. We want to look at caregiver support for Mrs. L. As I always tell caregivers, we do not want her to go down with the ship. She is the lifeline here, and she needs respite of her own. She needs to get out of the house because she cannot continue to care for him if she's with him all day long, every day. What about his irritability and aggression? So let's go on. Just to say about dementia, this is not one disease, this is a syndrome. There's many different causes, but we all know Alzheimer's is sort of the best known cause of it. It's the most common cause in this country. In other countries like Japan, vascular dementia is actually more common. Of course, there's the core cognitive impairment, which is the memory problem, but in addition, there are issues with speech and language, so finding words can be an issue. Carrying out everyday activities, recognizing people or things, and then organizing and planning, which I've talked about earlier. So just a word about behavior. As I said before, over 90% of patients with dementia at some point in their illness end up exhibiting these behavioral symptoms. We look at them in clusters, aggression, agitation, psychosis, depression, and apathy. But there's also a whole category of what I would call behaviors that don't fit into these categories, such as wandering, sexual inappropriate behaviors, things like spitting, that get people into trouble. So what I always end up saying is we often think of the memory part as the most problematic part of Alzheimer's or dementia, but actually what ends up getting people in a nursing home are these behaviors because they're very hard for caregivers to deal with. The etiology of behaviors is not well understood, and as we've talked about before with depression and interacting factors, it's likely a combination of all these things in many cases. So the cognitive loss due to dementia, some people may have a pre-existing psychiatric illness, environmental factors. Sometimes environments are too stimulating and other times they're not stimulating at all. Somebody's sitting in a chair, propped up in an angle, looking at blank walls. I think you'd start to become agitated too. Comorbid medical conditions, medication, pain, and delirium. Next slide. Briefly, these are associated with poor outcomes, so recurrent hospitalizations, increased lengths of stay. As I said, they trigger nursing home placement. They cause caregiver stress and depression. And importantly, as many of our caregivers are now becoming younger, they reduce caregiver income and employment. So we see many caregivers that end up missing a lot of work because of taking care of a loved one. Up to one-third of dementia care costs are actually attributed to these behavioral symptoms. So next slide. How are these usually managed in the real world? Anybody know? Anybody? Medications, and specifically antipsychotics. And although I'm a geriatric psychiatrist and I prescribe medications, I'm here to tell you that that is not a good thing. up to a quarter of our nursing home residents are on an antipsychotic. Who thinks that's too much? So, unfortunately, we don't have a good medication treatment. And not only would I say because we don't know exactly what to target in the brain, but also because I'm going to ask you, if the problem causing Mr. L's anger and irritability is a communication match between him and his wife, is an antipsychotic going to treat that? We're going to sedate Mr. L and maybe make him fall, but that's not going to help Mrs. L. So, unfortunately, this is where we're at in the field right now, and we're working really hard to change that, and that's a whole other lecture. There's actually a black box warning, but it did not lower the antipsychotic rates in this country very much because we don't have good alternatives yet. So what we're advancing in our center is the use of behavioral and environmental interventions. We want to find out what is underlying these behaviors. If it's a urinary tract infection, we need to treat that. And if it's pain, we need to treat that. There was a recent trial where they treated pain actively, and they significantly lowered these behaviors. So there's a lot of untreated pain out there among our dementia patients because they cannot tell us sometimes that they're in pain. Communication is a big issue. Earlier in the lecture, I mentioned that there's no college or training to become a caregiver. And we need that training out there because people are ill-equipped. It's not that they're doing a bad job, it's that they don't know how to do it. And then the environment needs to be looked at because that's something we can change pretty easily. So let's shift, and I'm going to try to go quickly because I don't want to get behind, but positive aging. This is really important and near and dear to my heart. So successful aging was defined in 1987, and this was a seminal paper in the journal Science, which is one of our biggest and most prestigious journals. And they define successful aging as no chronic disease, high cognitive and physical functioning, and active engagement in life. How many older people do you think meet these criteria? 5%. So this was actually very important because, number one, we'd only been focused on pathology up till now. So this was the first paper that said, hey, let's look at people who are doing this well. And it spurred research, so it was very important. But let's go on. This view of successful aging, this is supposedly a real guy, I don't know. It emphasizes good genes. So to meet those three criteria, you have to pick your parents well. But interestingly, twin studies tell us a much more complex story. So if you look at identical twins, lifespan and cognition are only partly heritable. So that means lifestyle is, and our choices, and what we do and how resilient we are can make a difference. Let's go on. And importantly, what the Rowan-Kahn study is, it didn't look at subjective feelings of aging. So this was a really cool study where they interviewed over 200 people, older adults. The majority in this study did not meet Rowan-Kahn criteria, a tiny fraction, but 92% thought they were aging well. So to me, that's fascinating. That's the other part of the story. George Valant is a very important figure in positive aging, and he's actually a positive ager himself, but for many years, he did longitudinal studies with thousands of patients, and he found that what it is to him, beyond the Rowan-Kahn criteria, are the individual is acting on the resources available to them to optimize the aging experience. And what does that mean? They react to change well, to disease and environmental imbalance. And if we put it more simply, what it means is you modify what you can and you deal with what you can't. So kind of putting it simply, but we'll go on. So predictors of positive aging, we know all these. I'm not going to bore you. They're tough. But physical activity, not smoking, and being a normal body mass. How about brain plasticity? We hear a lot about this now. People are actively, I don't know if people have seen on the internet, you know, buy this product and keep your brain active. The research and evidence for that isn't there yet, but what we do know is that the older people who do well activate and actually kind of, what would be the word, So instead of using one brain area that's not working as well, they use another one. They develop an alternative pathway. And the idea that people who do something new in later life, whether it's learning a new language or taking up dancing, that may be very effective for them. Engagement in social activities, as I talked about before, has actually been associated with a decrease in inflammatory markers, which are actually all those bad things that lead to cancer and heart disease. And predictors themselves, so just a few quotes from people. You cannot always change the things you do, but there are other, you cannot always do the things you did do, but there are other things you can do. Look for them. On my 100th birthday, I'm going to stop and think about what I'm going to do with the rest of my life. Keep your old friends, make new ones, don't isolate. And the last one speaks to resilience. A lot of traumatic things happen in life. Set it aside, look back, look with interest, and more on from there. Just briefly, depression and cognition, as we've talked about earlier, that's a negative to positive aging. So again, if you have all this stress, this is a complicated diagram, but the hypothalamic pituitary axis gets activated and can actually cause some badness in your brain. So again, we want to control those factors. Depression is treatable. We may be able to prevent some of this loss, and so it does not preclude our ability to age well. So this is another important thing. How do we explain positive aging? We know those older adults who are hit with losses, who are hit with medical illnesses. I had one woman that I knew who had bilateral amputations and still had one of the best attitudes I've ever seen. I mean, she lost both of her legs, and so she was the coolest, most positive lady. So how do you explain that? Well, if you look, this is sort of a goth teenager sulking. Older adults often report higher levels of well-being than younger adults. So next slide. And when they study them, they find that they use eye tracking, and they put people in the scanner, and they show them images. And older adults track preferentially to the positive images and ignore the negative images. We think this is partly because we have the concept of shrinking time horizon. So when you're 18, you think, you know, of all the time in the world, and as you get older, you may kind of realize time's more limited. They're better able to emotionally regulate. So putting it all together, they work harder to stay positive. Next slide. They may have smaller but more selective social networks. So my daughter has, I think, 800 Facebook friends. Are those people really her friends? Probably not. An older person may have, you know, a very small circle, but it may be very quality. Those people will actually do something for them. They may avoid negative interactions. So, you know, Joe always gets me upset. You know what? I'm just not even going to deal with him anymore. You know, just select that. And they stay positive in terms of their attention. And interestingly, if you look back, this is similar to the concept of wisdom. So people that age well seem to have achieved wisdom, this emotional regulation, this knowledge about life, and compassion. Next slide. So I've talked positively, but the first part of the talk was about depression. So how do I explain those people? Well, part of it may be that those older adults who can't stay positive fail to make this shift in emotional regulation. But what we think and what we're working on in Michigan is this may be modifiable. So we may be able to teach older adults the strategies that others use sort of naturally. We may be able to teach them cope. So I'll just briefly tell you about that. Over the last 2 years, we've been conducting a mindfulness project. How many here are familiar with the concept of mindfulness? Great. So mindfulness, again, very simplistically, we all drove here today. I was concentrating harder than some of you because I didn't know where I was going and my mom was giving me directions. But if we're going to a familiar place, we are practicing mindlessness. We don't even think about it. Sometimes you might get somewhere and think, how did I get here? I was thinking about everything else. We multitask. Mindfulness is staying in the present moment. We're not reliving the past. We're not previewing the future. We're staying right here. And we think that teaching older adults these strategies may help them to cope better in their life. So we're teaching them this, go on to the next slide, in groups. We're collaborating with social work and psychology, and this is actually our center here at Michigan. And we actually have had more older adults. I think we've had 75 now, and they attend group sessions. So there's two things that they accomplish there. They have the group social engagement, and they learn the techniques. They have two-hour sessions, and then they get home practice and assignments. And what we found is after they complete the sessions, we do pre- and post-measures. They have statistically significant improvements in depression, anxiety, and rumination, which is a big contributor to depression of going over and over things. I'm almost at the end here, but I think this feedback is really important. We've also asked them when they finish, give us your impressions. And my favorite quote here is, I'm more aware of activities that are nourishing versus depleting. I'm more careful not to engage in depleting relationships. So this is a person who didn't have mindfulness before, didn't have that emotional regulation, and he's been taught it. So I think that's a really cool thing if we can expand that. This older lady said, I'm happier and need fewer naps. Some painful memories resurfaced, and I realized I've been living in the past. This gentleman said, my mind is more organized, and I see the solution of what I was wondering the day before, and my mind has less clutter. So I really love these quotes. So I want to leave you with this. This is from Hill's Positive Aging book that if you guys haven't looked at, it's a very, very nice book. And he looks at it like this. Genetics is only this small part. Lifestyle is this piece, and mindset is actually this piece. So if we can get people to have this positive mindset, which again isn't just positive thinking, it's important. So last slide. So congratulations to the less than 10% of you who have the right genes to be successful agers. But for the rest of us, and this includes me, I have some funky cardiovascular genetics, we need to consider that our own view of aging will impact how we age, so our mindset, our resilience, and that we can modify these to age positively. So I'm just going to leave you lastly with, if you're interested, we have a website, Program for Positive Aging, where we expand more on these things, and we actually have a very active Facebook page where we present some of these ideas and sort of the lighter side of aging. So I'm going to stop there. I don't know if I have time for questions, or should we save them for later?
Dr. Kelsey,
okay. Yes.
Dr. Kelsey, in terms of the positive factors for positive aging, for successful aging, I didn't hear a lot about religious life, spiritual life. Is there any evidence that that actually enhances one's ability to age successfully?
Yes. So, again, I'm giving you like a Whitman sampler today of everything, and there's not enough time to go into all this, but certainly. You know, unfortunately, I think in research, sometimes that gets watered down to a concept of sort of spirituality. And so I don't have an answer for you about organized religion, because I think a lot of the studies that get funded look at a more all-encompassing view of spirituality. But I think it's critical. I think that, you know, sometimes I'm in church, at our church, and I think the Orthodox had the concept of mindfulness down. When you're in church, everything contributes to you being in that moment. The incense, the sounds, it takes you away from your, you know, everyday issues and brings you into the present. And so I really think that's very important, and I'm hoping that those who do that type of research will focus more on those components so that we better understand what those are. But certainly we know that for depression, organized religion can play a huge, huge part. Great question. Yes?
I was just going to say, I'm an ex-screener, and on every admin, you have to do a SAD scale, so you're screening for depression. And you also have, I have to point blank ask them, have you ever considered suicide? Mm-hmm. And you'll be surprised at the answers in family's presence and family's not presence.
Yes.
So I tend to not like family in the room because I'll get more than honest kids.
Yes.
And including street drugs. You'd be surprised.
Well,
we're doing a study right now with Cornell. It's a depression intervention, and our Cornell site, the drugs that they see, I mean, we're in Ann Arbor, so I think we're a little more shielded, but we've had to say, what about crack use? What about, I mean, really, people that are over 65, but I also think that with the baby boomers, we're going to be seeing this more, and we have to be prepared. Is there a question? Yes?
My last question. Could you say more, a little bit more about the treaty, looking at the environment? I was struck, for example, with the description of Mrs. L talking about her husband being irritable and so forth, and then the description of Mr. L where she's filling in his sentences. That's really irritating to me.
Yes.
So the idea that he would be have, that would be a problem that he has,
right,
rather than a problem which is in a learning and a living environment.
So that's a great question. The big part of what we're looking at, I would say that's not actually, environment actually means more of, you know, the physical environment, okay? That actually would be more communication, which is a huge part of what we work on with caregivers, because again, caregivers are trying to do their best. Nobody's trying to be, but a very common thing I see with someone like Mr. L is you'll say, well, this gentleman actually has a broken brain, you know, and they've never had that insight before because they think, well, he's just being stubborn. He's ornery. He's doing this on purpose. And we work with them to try to coach them on the communication technique. So, you know, it's not actually important for you to fill in the gaps right now. I can get that information for you later. If that kind of reliably triggers that response, let's change it up. So that's a great point. Thank you.
For more information on OCAMPR, please visit their website, ocampr.org. This has been the Orthodox Christian Network reporting, myocn.net.